and none of the players in this are going to have a problem burying inconveniences if it means holding the Accords together.
You mean me, she said.
I mean you, I said.
You could have hexed the saw already, she said.
No, I said, I couldn't have.
Well, you're not all dumb, she said, smiling faintly.
Remains to be seen, I said. I know you well enough to know there's no point trying to stop you, but I gotta know that you're walking into this with your eyes open, Murph.
She looked down for a long moment, then she looked back up at me and said, I have to do this. I stared at her bandaged, broken body for a long moment. Then I clenched my jaw and nodded once.
Okay, I said. I'll help.
Murphy's eyes softened for a moment. Then she took the oscillating saw to the cast and started slicing away at it. It didn't take her long to get the cuts made, though she hissed in discomfort a couple of times as she went.
Don't cut yourself, I said. If you bleed out, it'll take a week to clean up.
They're burns, she said, annoyed. The saw won't cut flesh, but it heats up the cast. I'm just too impatient.
No kidding, I said, lightly.
Okay, she said. Come help me pull it off.
I did.
Look, when you've been in as much cast as Karen had for as long as she had, the results are kind of gross. There was a buildup of dead skin, flakes of it white and hard, like scales where skin had been. There's no dressing that up.
Ugh, Karen said, wrinkling her nose as her arm came free. It's the smell that bugs me.
Junior high gym lockers were that bad, I said.
Ew, boys, she said.
She lifted her wounded arm a little, moving it slowly, wincing. Leg next, I said. That one was worse. She hissed as the cast came free and put a hand against her back.
Oh my God, she muttered. My hips forgot how to be at this angle.
She looked up at me, her face still pained.
I've got braces. We should put them on.
She broke off when I simply picked her up as carefully as I could. She got her good arm around my neck and helped as much as she was able.
What do you think you're doing? She asked.
Taking you to a hot bath, I said. Don't try to move. Just let me do it, okay? Her blue eyes went very soft for a moment, and she looked down.
For a minute, she said.
I took her to the bathroom, moved aside the assistance equipment that was there, and set her down gently on the commode. It took me only a moment to get the bath going, and then to help her out of her clothes and lower her carefully into the water. We didn't speak. I moved slowly, sluicing warm water over dried out skin where necessary, and let her soak in the warm water for a while. There was some gentle soap on hand, and after a time, I used that with just my hands, being as careful as I could to get the area clean without stripping up layers of skin down to the raw new stuff at the bottom in the process. Karen watched me at first. After a while, she closed her eyes and just sort of sank back into the tub, her limbs loose, her hair spread out a little in the water. She looked drawn, gaunt in the face and neck, and peaceful. I love you, I said.
She opened her eyes and blinked a couple of times. Then she lifted one ear out of the water and said, What did you say?
I smiled at her. Then I went back to running my hands gently down her arm, encouraging some of the dead stuff to come off. It would take a few days for her to get back to normal.
Oh,
she said, studying my face. Then she sat up in the water, twisted a little toward me, and slid both of her arms around my neck. She pulled my mouth down to hers with a strength that no longer surprised me. But the sudden, sweet, almost desperate softness of the kiss that followed nearly knocked me into the tub. And in the middle of it, she breathed, I love you.
Chapter 23.
We were about halfway to Chateau Wraith when Murphy asked, "You seen this? The Crown Vic behind us?" I asked. "Yeah." "Yeah, them," Murphy said impatiently. "And also the other two cars." I frowned. I was driving the Munstermobile, which Murphy hated riding in because the custom-sized seat wasn't adjustable, and her feet couldn't reach my pedals by almost a foot. The old car wasn't exactly built with the driver's lines of sight in mind, but I scanned the early morning traffic, frowning. It took me a good minute of looking to spot what Murphy had already alerted me to. A dark blue Crown Vic was following about three cars back, probably Rudolph and Bradley, in one of Internal Affairs' vehicles. Behind them, maybe three more cars back, was a battered old Jeep that looked like it would have been happier and more comfortable in the Rocky Mountains somewhere. And then there was a third car, a silver minivan, following along a ways behind the Jeep. "You're a little popular," Murphy said. "Hell's bells," I muttered. "Is it a whole surveillance team?" "They'd be the worst one in the world," Murphy said. "If they had three of them working together, there's no reason for all of them to keep us in sight the entire time." "Huh," I said, and watched the cars for a few minutes more. "They aren't working together. Three different parties tailing us?" "Rudolph and Bradley are here for me," Murphy said. "Who are the other two?" I chewed on the inside of my cheek for a second, thinking. Well, I suppose I could start driving like a lunatic and find out." "In this old death trap?" she asked and shuddered. "No, thank you. Should we let them follow us?" "Tough to know that if we don't know who was back there," I said. "Rudolph I don't much care about, but I'd rather not have Bradley stick his head into a noose. He's just trying to do his job right." "Well, you aren't going to lose a Crown Vic in this boat." "True," I said. "So maybe we do this the other way." "Magic?" she asked. "I don't really feel like walking the rest of the way either." I shook my head. "This old death trap was manufactured damn near a century ago," I said. "The whole point of driving it is because it can endure exposure to active magical forces and keep going vroom vroom." I squinted at the road. "You know, for a while." Murphy sighed. "What's your plan, Harry?" "We're going to get out of sight for a second, and then I'm dropping a veil over us," I said. I thought about it for a second. "We'll have to stay on the highway. If we pull off to the side, there's no way I can veil the dust and debris we'd kick up driving on the shoulder." "But other cars won't be able to see us," Murphy said. "And we won't be able to see them very well either," I said. "Be like driving in heavy rain." She grimaced, clearly unhappy at the entire situation. "And we're riding in a brick with no handling." "A brick that's heavier than a lot of the trucks on this highway right now," I said, "and made from all steel. Might not handle or accelerate like a modern car, but it's not made of drywall and cardboard either." Murphy gave me an impatient look. "Harry, do you even understand that modern engineering means that the lighter cars are actually considerably safer than cars like this one? Not when they hit cars like this one," I noted. "Yes, they're not meant to take dinosaurs into consideration," she growled. "Exit coming up," I said. "Here we go." I cut into the right-hand lane and accelerated smoothly and without noticeable effort from the old car. Between my old mechanic Mike and the Tinker Elves Mab had on call for maintenance and repairs, the Munstermobile purred like a 3,000-pound kitten. I went up the ramp with the accelerator mashed flat to the floor, and the cars following me had little choice but to emulate me. I timed my exit well, though. I gathered my will as I watched a couple of legitimate vehicles get in the way of my pursuers, and I reached the top of the ramp just in time for the green light. I went right through the intersection, back onto the entry ramp, and back down toward the highway. And as I went, I waved my hand in a gesture reminiscent of drawing a hood up over one's head and murmured, "Obscurata." There was an odd sensation, like a fine cold mist drifting down over me, and the interior of the car dimmed, as though heavy clouds had suddenly obscured the light, to the point where you'd have trouble telling what time it was by looking at the position of the sun. Visibility dropped suddenly and dramatically, Magic is awesome, but you don't get anything for free. Mess around with how much light is going to bounce off your body, and you're also futzing about with how much light makes it to your eyeballs, and for that matter, how much light is available to do things like keep you warm. Going unseen isn't a super complicated operation. Doing it without blinding and freezing yourself is the hard part. I had to settle on developing a veiling spell that would split the difference between visibility and comfort. By choice, obviously, and not because it was totally not my area of natural talent. And as a result, looking out of my veil was only a little easier than seeing into it. The world went dim, and just as it did, Murphy sat up straight, her eyes bright. "Hey," she said, "does this spell stop radar?" I said. I was already holding on to a veil and driving faster than was strictly safe, and my attention can only split so many ways. "Not mine. Molly's will stop almost anything, but I only bother with visible light because..." Murphy reached over while I was still talking and pushed down on my right knee, hard, pressing the accelerator flat again. "Faster." I gave her an annoyed look and then did it. The old engine gave a game growl, and we gathered speed going down the on-ramp, rapidly reaching speeds that would preclude any chance of getting off with a warning. I checked the rearview mirror in time to see our entourage come barreling onto the entry ramp behind us. Just as my more or less invisible car passed a pair of highway patrol vehicles poised on the side of the ramp, watching for speeders to come sailing under the bridge. I had a chance to see both highway patrol officers come to attention behind the wheel, their eyes on their radar gun readouts, then switching to the apparently empty road. And both men locked eyes on our pursuers, the only apparent visible source of the readings on their instruments. I flashed by them and just had time to see their bulbs coming on before they vanished into the obscurement generated by my veil. "Oh," I said to Murphy in admiration, "that's just mean." "Right?" she asked me, smiling. She patted my leg and said, "Good job following directions." Which was another way to say, "Thank you for trusting me." I chewed on my lip. If I drove in the right lane, I'd have to go slow to avoid problems, and I'd have to dodge anyone trying to make it over for the exits. If I drove in the far left, I'd run the risk of idiots just slamming into me from behind. I liked my chances better in a lower-speed accident, so I got behind a truck in the right-hand lane, crept up close enough that he couldn't have seen me in his mirrors, and stayed there. "Aren't you worried about people flipping out when you appear all of a sudden?" she asked. I said, "not so much. People work really hard not to notice unusual things, generally speaking. You know the drill by now," I shrugged. "Most people have encountered something that looks damn peculiar, that just doesn't fit. And mostly they explain it away, no matter how thin the explanation sounds, or they just don't think about it. Everyone says they want magic, but no one really wants to feel confused and frightened, or stay awake at night worried about dark forces they can do nothing about." "And magic is that," she said. "That's some of what magic is," I said. "It's also a lot of good stuff, like all power. It depends on what you do with it." "And yet, like all power," Murphy said, "it tends to corrupt." Well, tough to argue with that. The number of people capable of wielding power with a capital P, or power, responsibly, was never exactly going to threaten the world's food supply. Out of the mist of my veil's obscurement, the jeep that had been following us appeared. It pulled up directly behind me and then flashed its headlights and three quick signals. "I handled the other two," Murphy said. "This one is yours." "Yeah," I said, peering at the rearview mirror. Then I dropped the veil abruptly, hit my right blinker, and took the next exit ramp. Murphy arched an eyebrow, but looked at me. I pulled off to the side of the road, and the jeep pulled up behind me.
"Is that who I think it is?" Murphy asked.
"Uh-huh," I said. "Contracted him to help out." Murphy eyed me and said, "Huh, maybe you do learn, eventually. Amazing, right?" I leaned back and way over and unlocked the rear passenger side door. Goodman Gray got into the back seat and slouched down wearily. He was perhaps one of the most forgettable people I'd ever seen. He was unremarkable in every way. A man of medium height and build, blandly not bad-looking. And if you looked real close, you could see Native American background in him somewhere. He was also one of the most dangerous shapeshifters in the world. He worked for $1 per case, and he had saved me from meeting a truly ugly end in Tartarus. "What the hell, man?" I asked as he settled in. "You're supposed to be watching Justine."
"Me and everyone else," he complained. "You should have asked me about my group rates. Hey, Ms. Murphy."
"Goodman," Murphy replied. "Still working for these unsavory characters, I see."
"Risk of the trade, ma'am," Gray replied.
"Hold on now," I said. "Who else is watching Justine?"
"Who isn't?" Gray asked.
"White court, cops, feds, some wackadoo who is either a perv or a nutcase, doing it all by hacking into surveillance cameras online."
"That sounds like it's probably paranoid Gary," I said.
"He has issues." Murphy frowned and said, "Wait, how in the world did you find out all of this?" Gray shrugged. Murphy arched an eyebrow at him. "How sure are you about your information?"
"Ms. Murphy, please."
Gray brushed imaginary lint off his shoulder and sniffed.
"Like Dresden here, I do some of the work myself, and for some of it, I have people."
"Feds, though?" she asked. "I mean, locals, I can understand, but what are the feds doing involved?"
"We tipped off Agent Tilly, remember?" I asked.
Gray nodded.
"Isn't Tilly, but it's some of his guys from the local field office."
I grunted. "Everyone know about everyone else?" I asked.
"They know in part, and they understand in part," Gray said, somewhat smugly. "I know about all of them."
"Unless you don't," Murphy pointed out.
"Unless I don't," Gray allowed, unperturbed. "But anyone who makes a move on the girl is going to set off about 3 different groups of dangerous people."
"And I figured you needed to know what was up."
"Yeah," I muttered. "Maybe I do."
I closed my eyes for a second, thinking.
"Don't hurt yourself," Gray said.
I opened an eye and gave him an annoyed look that was by necessity at only half strength. It didn't seem to damage him. Then I closed my eye again and kept thinking.
"One of the people surveilling Justine is the person who threatened her," Murphy said. "And they must have given Thomas an ultimatum. And because he's an idiot like you, Harry, he didn't tell her about it."
"Yep, feels like that's the right ballpark," I said.
"Oh, crap," Gray sighed. "This is about the assassination attempt."
"Yeah," I said. "I think someone leveraged him into it by threatening the girl."
"Huh," Gray said, sitting back.
"Well, he's a dead man now. Svartalfs don't kid around."
I opened my eyes and looked at Gray in the mirror. The shapeshifter shrugged and returned my gaze with a blank expression that showed neither hostility nor fear.
"Oh, it's personal, you and him, huh?"
"He stood beside me when it was bad," I said.
"Ah," Gray said, as if enlightened. "Okay."
I nodded, and so did Murphy.
"So, what do you want I should do?" Gray asked.
"Nothing's changed," I said. "Protect Justine."
"Yeah," he said, drawing the word out. "But there's a lot of players here. Sometimes the best defense is a good offense, right?"
I scowled. "Hey, who's putting up the money around here?"
Gray shrugged and said to Murphy, "Do you want to explain it to him?"
"He's one person, Harry. As remarkable as his abilities might be," Murphy said thoughtfully, "given that there are multiple threats, if he isn't standing in arm's reach of her, there's not much he can do if someone decides to shoot her through the window."
My chest panged a bit. It did that sometimes when I imagined someone I knew getting shot. It did that every time when I imagined it being me.
"Let me get closer and find out more," Gray said. "More information might help a lot." And if I can't get anything useful or turn up the actual threat, I can vanish the girl, get it to a safe house.
You have one of those? Murphy asked. Gray winked at her.
Let's just say I can borrow one.
I nodded, frowning. Can you do email?
Who doesn't do email?
Gray began, but then looked at me.
Oh, yes.
Murph, can you give him Paranoid Gary's email? I asked. My last fresh one was before I got hurt, she said. He may have moved on by now. She took a notepad out of her jacket pocket and flipped through the pages. She found the one she wanted, turned to a fresh page, and started writing. Murphy hadn't been on the force for a while, but her habits had not changed much. She tore off the page and gave it to Gray. The email address was a string of gibberish letters and numbers. Here, make sure you tell him who gave you the address or he'll assume you're one of them. He accepted the note, glanced at it once, and handed it back to her.
And why are you trusting this guy again?
It's possible that Lara is playing games with me, I said, so her people might be behind it. The local cops are probably in Marcone's pocket, and I don't trust him any further than I can kick him. I don't know why the feds are involved or who is pushing them, but even though I like Tilly, he's a square, and this seems like a damned odd play for him. And I've never really been comfortable dealing with government agents.
Ah, Gray said. And the internet guy is safe?
Paranoid Gary is a creep and a weirdo, but he's our creepy weirdo, I said. If he's the one doing the hacking thing, he can probably assist you. If it isn't him doing it, he can probably find out who it is.
If he will, Murphy said.
Sure, Gray said, almost jovially.
Because paranoid, he shook his head. Well, you don't ever bore me, Dresden.
I'm good like that, I said.
At least you pay well, he said, and nodded to Murphy.
Ma'am?
You're going to need someone to relieve you eventually, Murphy said. Only if we do this for a couple of weeks, he said. He nodded to her, then he got out of the Munstermobile and walked back to his old Jeep.
Useful guy, she noted, as Gray cranked up the vehicle and left, turning back toward Chicago.
Very.
You trust him?
Well, I hired him. I trust him to live up to that.
So did Nicodemus, Murphy noted. But someone else had hired him first. So what if someone else hired him first again?
I grimaced. Thanks for bringing that up.
You're a good person, Harry. You trust people too easily. She shifted in her seat, wincing.
The leg, I asked.
Hip, she said shortly. Don't forget your cold medicine.
Murphy had given me something that promised to remove mucus and sneezing and coughing and aching for 8 hours at a time, about 7 hours ago. I opened the little bottle and took more of it.
Are we getting old? I asked her. Is this what it's like?
She smiled slightly and shook her head.
It is what it is, she eyed me.
Do you think Lara is behind this?
My instinct says no, but she's tricky enough to try it. And it's called treachery because you don't see it coming. I said,
wow, though. She's standing really close to Mab's toes on this one, no matter how you look at it.
How she reacts to the proposal is going to tell us a lot, Murphy said.
You ever get involved in one of my cases and find yourself drowning in an overabundance of information? I asked.
She snorted, point.
It might tell us something, I said, best we can hope for.
We're moving ahead blind, she noted.
Maybe.
I pulled the car back onto the road and toward the highway.
But there's no use in wasting time.
Chapter 24 Freitas met us at the door of Chateau Wraith and said,
Seriously? You just drive here and walk up to the front door? Obvious much?
Oh, I said, it's so cute when you guys try to employ the vernacular. It's just never quite on point, you know?
The ginger Valkyrie gave me a narrow-eyed look and said,
Don't make me stop this car.
Somehow worse and better at the same time, I said approvingly.
Freitas snorted.
Who's the mortal?
Please, Murphy said. You know who I am, and you know what I do.
Freydis showed her teeth. The Ein Hajaran like you, Ms. Murphy, but that doesn't give you a pass. This is an internal matter. You aren't coming into it.
I already have, Murphy said, years ago.
Unless Ms. Wraith would prefer me to make a non-secret of her open secret about her father.
Are you threatening my employer? Freydis asked in a very level tone.
I am a threat to your employer, Murphy replied calmly. But there's no reason we can't be civilized about it.
I could kill you right now, Freydis noted.
You could try, Murphy answered. But however that turned out, your boss would be working without Dresden's help. Freydis narrowed her eyes and then looked at me. What do you say, Dresden?
Good morning, I said. Nothing further to add.
The woman speaks for you?
For herself, but I don't see the point in repeating her.
Her injuries, Freydis began. Murphy didn't seem to move quickly, but everything happened with smooth precision as she stepped forward and to one side. She drove the elbow of her injured arm at Freydis's midsection. It didn't hit hard, but it forced the Valkyrie's balance off, and Murphy followed up with a step into her as her cane clattered to the porch. She stepped into the Valkyrie, pinning her against the side of the doorway, and Murphy's gun came out and nestled up under Freydis's chin. I am getting tired, Murphy said, in a faintly annoyed tone, of people using that phrase as if I was not standing right here.
Freydis stared down at Murphy for a long moment. If she was bothered by the gun under her chin, it didn't show on her face. She nodded and turned her palms up. Enter, warrior.
Murphy met her eyes and nodded. She withdrew carefully, keeping the gun on Freydis until the last possible second, then took a limping step back. I picked up her cane and held it for her while she put the gun away, her eyes still on the Valkyrie. She accepted the cane with a nod. I gestured toward the house and said, "Lead on, then." Freydis lifted a hand and rubbed briefly at the spot on her chin where the gun's muzzle had left a mild indentation. Then she said to Murphy, "Are you seeing anyone?"
Murphy blinked.
"Mortals make the best lovers by far," Freydis explained. "And this job means I'm basically sexually frustrated around the clock. But it's hard to find mortals I respect."
Murphy's cheeks turned bright pink. Freydis frowned slightly and glanced from Murphy to me and back.
"I don't mind sharing."
I'm Catholic, Murphy said.
Freydis's eyes shone with a wicked sparkle. "I don't mind conflicted, either." Murphy gave me a somewhat desperate glance.
"Huh. I'd officially seen everything now. Murphy asking for a rescue. From monsters and madmen, she'd never cried uncle. It had taken a redhead."
"Business first, maybe," I suggested.
"We could all die tonight," Freydis said, "but as you wish."
Freydis led us to the rear of the chateau and outside, to gardens I had never seen before. There was even a hedge maze, or maybe an hedge maze, depending on who you asked, a good 10 feet high, and Freydis led us right into it.
"I apologize for the walk, Ms. Murphy," Freydis said.
Murphy limped along grimly, leaning on her cane.
"I'm fine."
Freydis nodded but glanced my way, and it was possible that her steps gradually, imperceptibly, slowed a bit over the next couple of minutes, until we reached the center of the maze. We stepped into a grassy bower where apple trees had been planted beside a beautifully laid out, not pond. It was definitely a water feature, complete with an abstract statue of a pair of faceless lovers intertwined in its center, with water rippling down over them. A party had taken place the night before, apparently. There were bottles and plates scattered with the remnants of food lying about on the grass, along with articles of clothing, many of them ripped. The center of the bower was
Well, I'm sure it had some kind of official garden title, but it amounted to a giant canopy bed, big enough for at least half a dozen people, and probably more if you squeezed, gauzy white curtains all around it. The morning light made them misty, translucent, and the breeze, enough to keep away the promise of another hot day for the moment, stirred them in rippling waves. Sitting cross-legged at the head of the bed, sipping a tiny cup of espresso, was Lara Wraith. She was wearing an oversized blue t-shirt and old cut-off sweatpants with paint stains on them. Her hair was rumpled, and she wasn't wearing any makeup at all. As we entered, she looked up, and her eyes were absolutely sapphire blue, almost gem-like. She stretched, as anyone might in the morning, though not many of us would have made it look that good in those clothes, and smiled at us.
Harry, Ms. Murphy, good morning.
I looked around. Late night?
Your people and the Svartovs aren't the only ones I'm practicing diplomacy with, she replied. And it's always a good idea to eat a large meal before one expects difficulty.
Murphy leaned on her cane. You prepare for trouble by having sex?
I'm a vampire, Ms. Murphy, Lara said calmly. I have certain physiological needs, so yes. It is also often necessary for celebrating a victory or recovering from a defeat.
I'm sensing a pattern, Murphy said in a very dry voice. Lara laughed. It was just a laugh, with none of the supernatural come-hither in her voice I'd heard before.
Our information suggested you'd be in the casts for another week.
4 days, Murphy corrected her, and I got bored. But this isn't really a social call.
Oh, how unprofessional of me, Lara said.
I peered around and said, someone bugged your office, did they? Lara lifted her little cup to me in a salute.
And they say you're a mindless thug.
Who? I asked.
Even if I felt like sharing my, she fluttered her eyelashes, intimate details with you, Harry, what makes you think it would be wise to do so?
Just asking, I said, one professional to another.
I know you meant that to be flattery, Lara said, her tone wry. So I'm going to take your intention into consideration.
She visibly considered it for a moment before saying,
I'm not sure, but too many leaks have happened in the past few weeks. I'm secure against strictly technical means of doing it, and I've never had issues with my people betraying me.
Not even in the Wraith Deeps? I asked. She waved a dismissive hand.
Oh, that was just everyday treachery. That's different.
How?
It was kept mostly in-house, she said. It benefits all the White Court to have the strongest and most capable leadership possible. Challenging that leadership for control of our people's aims is good for everyone.
I sputtered. I almost died. So did you.
Don't be a whiner, Harry, Lara said. Neither of us did. When my people turn on me, we keep it mainly between us. This information has been falling into outside hands. I work with consultants in such matters, of course, but they haven't been able to find any magical surveillance either. My working theory is that it would take one of your people to manage a spell they couldn't detect.
I frowned. The White Council tended to wage information-based warfare whenever it could, right up until it was time to start ripping satellites out of orbit and triggering volcanic eruptions on the theory that with enough knowledge, leverage would be far more effective, obviating the necessity for open war. It was an obnoxious, arrogant stance to take on such matters, and it worked. Mostly. That didn't mean that being the target of a full court press on surveillance was fun. I hadn't much liked it when they'd been monitoring me more closely earlier in my career. Wizards could be really annoying sometimes.
Would either of you care for coffee? She asked.
We did.
Freydis set us up, her eyes always looking at nothing specific, as if she was trying to take in everything around us at once.
So, Lara said,
why are you here?
It's about tonight, I said. She gave me a sharp look and then glanced at Murphy.
You demanded my help, I said. You're getting it, my way.
Something that very nearly resembled anger changed the shape of her face, made it look remote and cold. It was gone again after a breath.
I see.
Her eyes went to Murphy.
I apologize that you were dragged into the matter.
Then why'd you do it? Murphy asked. I shifted my weight a little so that my hip pressed against Murphy's. Well, it pressed against her upper arm.
Lara took that in for a moment and nodded slowly. I see. I trust that you can keep this matter a professional one.
Try to stab us in the back or feed on either one of us, and I'll make holes in your skull, Murphy said. Play it straight with us, and we'll all be fine. I like your brother.
Did you just threaten me in my own garden? Lara asked.
I just explained our stance to you, Murphy said. Lara glanced at me. I shrugged. Better to have it out in the open than under the table. She smiled and shook her head.
I suppose we are all here for Thomas, are we not?
Which is why we've come, I said. This can't be a smash-and-grab run. Lara frowned.
Given the security around him, I don't see any option.
Do you want a war with Svartalfheim? What happened to avoiding open conflict? She gave me a pained glower and looked abruptly away.
The equation changed when they moved my brother. I'll be facing considerable in-house trouble if my own sibling is put to death. My enemies within the court will use it as a justification to rally against me. If I can't protect my own family, how can I protect them, etc.? She shook her head. Allies outside the court will also be watching. A quick conflict and a brokered peace could make my position stronger than it currently is.
So this is all about power, Murphy noted.
It is also about power, Lara corrected her. For people in positions like mine, power concerns are a constant. But Thomas is my only brother. He's frequently vexing, but, she shrugged, I like him. Family isn't something one discards lightly.
I thought of the old man. No, it isn't, I said quietly. So, what if I told you I thought we could get Thomas out clean, no bloodshed?
To what advantage? She asked. Etri's people would track him and kill him. The accorded nations will theoretically be honor-bound to help.
I think I can keep him hidden, I said, from all of them.
Even your own people?
Especially those assholes, I said. Lara's eyebrows climbed.
If we do it smoothly enough, Murphy said, we can do this without violence and it will be a fait accompli. He'll be out of their hands and unreachable. You'll have time to talk things down. And since you'll have done it without shedding more blood, there will be pressure from the accorded nations for Etri to restore peace and resolve the matter via Wehrguild. A very steep Wehrguild, Lara noted.
Still, cheaper than slugging it out with the Svartals, I said. Or slapping down another rebellion among your own people.
Lara frowned, narrowing her eyes in thought for a full minute.
Her chin bobbed up and down very slightly.
I take it Mab is fine with this?
Mab can be very creative about what she notices or doesn't, I said. Particularly if the forms are observed correctly. The lack of bloodshed at what amounts to her party will go a long way toward pacifying her.
But she doesn't know, Lara pressed.
She loaned me to you so that she wouldn't have to know.
Lara finished the last of her espresso. Meaning that there might well be consequences for you in the aftermath.
Especially if we screw it up, I said.
If we attempt and fail, Lara noted, my position is even worse than if I do nothing.
He's family.
Her sapphire eyes met mine for a dangerous second and then turned to Murphy. I take it this is your plan.
I don't get weepy about who gets credit, Murphy said.
as long as the plan gets results. Lara took a deep breath. Then she said, All right, walk me through it.
Chapter 25. It's not complicated, Murphy said. Lara tilted her head and said, Please don't assume I'm too thick to see the obvious options. You've been in the building for meetings of the Brighter Future Society, Murphy said. I trained there on a daily basis for more than a year with the guards. Lara arched an eyebrow. I assumed you were watchdogging the imperiled families who were staying there.
I was, Murphy said.
I was also learning everything I could about the place, she snorted. Marcone owns it. Keep your friends close.
Lara's smile was somehow both appreciative and predatory.
So you have information I didn't when I was making plans.
The strong rooms are in the basement, Murphy said.
Only one way in and out, Lara noted.
That's not the first problem to plan for, Murphy said.
I nodded. Before we go in, we need to set up a way out.
I arrived at the reception on time, wearing my silver suit and my warden's cloak. It wasn't the original, which I preferred, sort of. It was a dress cloak, made of shimmery gray silk of some kind, and it didn't have any tears or burns or patches on it. Once again, I walked in with the wardens and the members of the senior council, though this time Ramirez, dressed as I was, lagged a bit behind, leaning more heavily on his cane than the day before. Predators would note that he was an easy target. Isolated and falling behind like that. And this summit could be fairly described as a convocation of some of the deadliest predators around. I slowed my pace to walk next to him. That way he wouldn't be alone. It was a muggy night, with light, sullen rainfall that made the warm air smell like hot asphalt and motor oil and cut grass. The rain was something to be expected when powerful delegates of both summer and winter were in proximity for any length of time. Hey, man, I said quietly. You okay? Ramirez set his jaw, glanced at me for a second, and then said, I will be. Right now it's inconvenient. At least I'm not stuck in a wheelchair anymore. What happened? I asked. The muscles in his jaw flexed before he spoke. Tangled with the wrong monster.
Line of duty? He shrugged a shoulder.
As it turned out, I frowned. There was enormous anger and pain in the spaces between his words. I'd seen Carlos get hurt during the war with the Red Court. It had never stopped his smile for very long. This had.
I'm sorry, I said.
His lips pressed into a line.
Yeah, he gave his head a little shake, as if dislodging an insect.
I heard about the vote in the council, man. It's bullshit, however inconvenient it might be for them. Whether any of them like it or not, you're a wizard, Harry.
You're a wizard, Harry, I growled.
He didn't smile, but an amused glint came to his eyes.
Point is, I've already cast my vote on your behalf. So have most of the other wardens. I was quiet for a second, with my throat a little tight.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, well, we're just the guys who have to do the fighting and the dirty work, he said bitterly. All the wizards that sit on their fat asses all day, who knows? To them, you're scary.
You didn't use the curse so much, I noted, and he'd never sounded so bitter doing it either.
Man.
Something had done a number on Ramirez.
I made a mental note to grab a bottle of something very flammable and have a long talk with Carlos before long.
How's Karen doing? He asked.
Like always, but slower and grouchier.
I heard what she did. Went hand to hand with Nicodemus Arcleone and survived.
You got that backwards, but yeah, I said. Difference is, she can still live in her house.
Ha, he said, with a flash of teeth.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe how many people have come to the council asking us to help them find him.
Are we?
Hell yes,
Ramirez said. Guy's a goddamn monster, but he's slippery as hell.
Sounds about right.
Someone's gonna get him, sooner or later.
Can't be soon enough for me, I said. So, what's the deal with another reception? Thought that was last night. Is one party not enough?
Oh, God, no, Ramirez said. That was just an icebreaker. Tonight is opening ceremonies.
Which is another party.
Obviously. The Accords provide space for a lot of business at a summit meeting. New applicants, addressal of grievances, public announcements, explicitly stating the purpose of the summit, that kind of thing. That's what opening ceremonies are for, before the actual haggling starts. I grunted. Wee.
Don't you like parties, Harry? Ramirez asked. A ghost of his old humor came into his voice and face.
Well, I said, I heard at least there'll be cute girls.
Wham! It was nearly audible. How fast his expression became a closed door.
Los? I asked.
He shook his head once and said,
just hurting. I'll get some painkillers after the reception.
I nodded. Like fire, pain was something that seemed to have its own extra-heavy existential mass. Magic could dull or erase pain, but not without side effects that were nearly as serious as those of medicinal palliatives. It took someone with centuries of experience in that kind of magic to do it safely, and that was neither one of us. I had 8 years on Carlos, but by wizard standards, both of us were entry-level noobs in a lot of ways. It made sense that he wouldn't want to have his senses dulled on a night like this one. Which made what I was about to do difficult, as well as painful. And necessary. I put a hand on his shoulder and said, hang in there, man. Once we get through this, maybe we should get Wild Bill and Yoshimo and go camping again or something.
Sure, he said in a neutral voice. That might be good.
He didn't notice the little ampule in my hand, or how it broke and spread the liquid inside onto his cloak and my skin. No one would notice one extra splash of liquid on his clothes. I lowered my hand, palming the broken ampule, and Ramirez didn't notice a thing. Why would he? He was a friend. He trusted me. I felt sick.
Are you sure you can pull that off on another wizard, Dresden?
Lara asked, her voice intent.
No reason it shouldn't work, I said. And if I do it to anyone but another wizard, I'm definitely crossing the line, just like that stupid bastard with the violin.
If you're caught...
If any of us are caught, we're all screwed, I said. No risk, no reward.
Point, Lara said. What next?
Next is plausibly getting you both out of the reception, Murphy said.
What do we use to do that? Lara asked. Murphy smiled grimly.
Expectations.
We passed by Childs and his security dog again to re-enter the great hall. Once more, the room had been arranged by camps, borders subtly marked by style of furniture and swathes of overhead silk, giving the whole place a bit of a circus atmosphere, with a single difference. In the exact center of the room, at the focus of all the camps, a small circular speaking stage had been erected. Music was playing, violins again. Evidently, Marcone had managed to replace the offending she fiddler from the night before. Or maybe the guy lived. I had the same emotions either way.
Speaking of which, the man himself was present tonight, sitting and speaking with Etri on a deep green and dark, carved redwood, old-world leather sofa, stuffed thick with cushioning, with gold studs as upholstery pins. Baron Marcone was a handsome man of middle years, dressed in an immaculate gray business suit. Perhaps slightly taller than average, he had barely changed in all the years I'd known him. The few marks of age that had come upon him only made him look more reserved, severe, and dangerous. He was flanked by Sigrun Gard and Hendrix, like always.
guard was a woman who was tall enough to play basketball and built like a powerlifter, visibly girded with muscle. She wore a suit that was every bit as nice as Marcone's, and her golden blonde hair was held back into a tight, complicated, neat braid that left nothing much to grab onto. The lines of the suit were marred by the axe she wore strapped to her back, but it didn't look like the fashion police were going to have the courage to give her a hard time about it. Hendricks, who stood at the other end of the couch, was a ginger Mack truck wearing a suit. He had a heavy brow ridge and had grown out a short beard that had come out several shades darker than his hair, and he had hands like shovels. His suit had been custom-made, but not to fit him. It was spending all its time trying not to show off the weapons he was doubtless carrying underneath it. Marcone glanced up as the White Council's delegation entered together, and he looked at me for a moment, his expression neutral. The last time I'd taken a big case, I'd done considerable damage to his vault's exterior, if not much to the contents inside, and one of his people had been killed by the lunatics I'd been working with. I'd paid the Ware Guild for the man's death, but appeasing someone and being at peace with them were two very different things. I returned the look with as much of a poker face as I could, and we both looked elsewhere at the same moment, as if we'd planned it. I clenched my jaw. Jerk. I couldn't think of a time when I hadn't wanted to punch the guy right in his strong-jawed mouth. I briefly toyed with the image of Marcone, with several missing teeth, reclining in a dentist chair for repair work while Guard and Hendricks menaced the poor DDS with their glowers, and it made me smile. There. Who says I can't put on a proper party face? I knew the outfit had doctors. Did they also have dentists? If any underworld boss in the world had a dental plan for his employees, it would be Marcone. Which reminded me, I should probably be looking into a checkup for Maggie before she went to her new school in the fall and... No, wait, focus, Dresden. Survive the evening now. Plan Maggie's dental appointments later. So, I plunged into the party. I exchanged brief words with River Shoulders as he spoke to Ivana. Across from Winter's blue and purple silks were Summer's golden and green colors, and I stepped up to the edge of their camp to trade nods with the Summer Lady, Sarissa, and a firm handshake with Fix, the Summer Knight, my opposite number on that side of things, and a decent guy, all while being eyed by the Summer She security detachment they had with them. I walked past the LaChase clan and received several dark glares, which I returned with interest. I'm not particularly tolerant on the subject of ghouls, due to the fact that I'd seen them eat some kids I'd been teaching during the war with the now-deceased Red Court. Their particular clan hadn't been all that easy on people living in the Mississippi Delta region, either, and I'd butted heads with them on side cases in the past. Some of LaChase's people looked like they wanted to start a fight, but a few glances toward Mab's still empty black chair in Winter's camp seemed to make them think better of it. I'd be fine with fighting them if they wanted to start things. I'm not saying that the only good ghoul was a dead ghoul, but I'd never met one that made me think otherwise, and I'd seen too many corpses they'd made to let it bother me. But as long as they respected the truce, they were guests and under the protection of their host. Maybe I could hope for some kind of misunderstanding later on, when the talks were done and everyone was heading home. There were actually a few folks dancing in the center of the floor, in the open space around the speaker's podium. Ivana and River Shoulders made a particularly odd couple, with River holding the Svartov lady completely off the ground with one hand while walking through the steps of a cautious, stately waltz. Freydis absolutely slinked up to me, looking fabulous in her white and silver dress. Granted, most ladies wouldn't have had quite so many fine old scars to show off as she did, but they only lent her a dangerously sexy aura. The red-haired Valkyrie gave me a dazzling smile, ran her hand over my arm, and said, "Hey there, Saitamado.
Who's a girl got a stab to get a dance around here? I smiled and said, very quietly, Mab's not even here yet. Freitas ignored my concern and sidled close to me, sliding her left hand up to my shoulder and taking my left hand with her right.
Oh, no, you have to dance with a stunning woman for a few extra moments. Whatever will you do, poor bastard?
Well, she had a point there. So I lifted my arm, put a hand on her waist, and stepped into a simple waltz. Freitas hadn't waltzed before, but she picked it up fast and within a minute was flowing gracefully through the steps with me. She squeezed my left hand and asked, The scars? Burns? Black Court Vampire had an office building and a psychic arm lock, I said. One of her Renfields had a makeshift flamethrower.
Just the hand, or does it go all the way up?
To the wrist, on the front, I said. Less on the back. I was holding up a shield with that hand.
You killed them, I take it.
Why would you say that?
In my experience, burns make mortals rather vengeful.
It's a long story, I said. Vamp got away. Mavra.
Ah, that one, Freitas said. She's earned a bit of a reputation over the years.
Oh?
I probably shouldn't tell you this for free, but I adore dancing. I rarely get the chance, and my boss likes you, Freitas said.
I stopped to glance over at Vatterung in his chair. Once more, he was seated across from Faravax, and the two were regarding each other steadily. He seems like the kind of guy who would tell you to say something like that when he asked you to pass on some information to me, I said.
Her green eyes flashed with appreciation.
Oh, you just went from a 3 to a 6, Sidemar.
I like men who look past the surface of things, and you can dance.
Lucky me, I said. So?
So if you get me drunk enough and no one else more interesting turns up, I could show you all kinds of interesting scars. Bring your woman and we can skip some of the drinking.
That made my cheeks feel warm. I meant Mavra, I said.
Just that when we last spotted her movements about a year ago, Freitas said, unperturbed at the change of subject. If you were counting on her never coming back, you might need to go over your numbers again.
Reunion week around here, I complained.
Oh, poor boy, Freitas said, thrusting out her lower lip mockingly. Live as long as I have and you'll realize that none of us ever really escapes the past. It just keeps coming back to haunt you.
I haven't seen much to suggest otherwise, I admitted. The piece ended and we segued from a waltz into a foxtrot, which again she picked up almost immediately, and during one of the turns I saw a movement out of the corner of my eye, and the temperature of the room seemed to drop about 3 degrees. There. Is that her?
Cold, pretty, and scary? Freitas asked.
Yes, that's her. Should we do it now? Wait for her to get settled, I said. Her green eyes tracked past my shoulder, watching intently.
She's talking to the big Grendelkin.
He's not a Grendelkin, I muttered. She arched a brow at me. You'll have to trust me. The forest people are different than the Grendelkin.
Big, hairy, strong, stinky. If it walks like a Grendel and talks like
you and I said, meeting the Valkyrie's eyes, are about to have a serious argument. Freitas' eyes flared with defiance, but she looked away first.
That's River Shoulders. He's okay. Tell your boss I said that.
Why don't you do it yourself?
Because as long as he's using a messenger, I will too, I said. Not sure why he's keeping his distance, but I'll respect it.
Could be he doesn't want to look too chummy with me here. Point is, tell him that River Shoulders isn't a Grendelkin.
He's chatty enough to be one, Freitas growled.
The next turn, let me see River Shoulders speaking earnestly, how else, to Mab. Mab was listening to him with intense focus. How else? I saw her nod, speak a short phrase, and turn to continue toward her chair in her appointed camp.
Molly was walking a step behind her and to her right. She paused to put a hand on River's massive arm and say something that made him let out a rumbling chuckle. She beamed up at him, patted his arm again, and kept pace with Mab. There, Freitas said a moment later as the turn took Mab out of my sight. She's sitting. I leaned down close to Freitas's ear and said, Well, I guess we should do it then. Nothing personal, Tiger, she murmured back into mine. Then Freitas drew back, her face drawn up in an expression of outrage, and smacked me. Okay, maybe that was understating it. The Valkyrie, who could potentially have lifted an entire automobile and chucked it a short distance, dealt me an open-hand blow to the cheekbone with the full power of her body. It was like taking a right cross from a professional slugger. If I hadn't rolled with it, she'd have knocked my startled ass completely unconscious. The script called for me to grope her a bit as she pulled away from me, exactly the kind of behavior everyone expected from the winter night, but my brains were so scrambled I could barely manage to make it look like a socially awkward hug she was avoiding. She stalked over to the White Quartz camp, straight up to Lara. The redhead looked fantastic and drew the attention of the room as she did it. She reported to Lara in low tones, thrusting a fingertip at me along the way, her expression going from outrage to strain to visible distress. Lara glared daggers at me from across the floor, sliding a supportive arm around Freitas' shoulders. She guided the other woman across the room, pausing at the same doorway where I'd gotten some quiet space last night. She spoke to one of the caterers and then stepped through with Freitas. The room had gone quiet except for the musicians, and everyone was looking at me.
Sir Knight, came Mab's voice very clearly and very calmly. That got everyone's attention, though they mostly tried not to be obvious about it. Even Vatterung and Faravax broke their casual staring contest to regard what else was happening in the room. I could have sworn Mab's gown was deep purple when she entered the hall a moment ago, but when I looked up back at her seat, the cloth had turned as dark as midnight, and streaks of black were flowing through her silver white hair. We were about 10 seconds into this heist, and Mab was already halfway into her full form as judge, jury, and executioner of winter. Perfect. I looked aside and found myself facing my grandfather. Ebenezer gave me a look that was as panicked as I'd ever seen him give. I wanted to reassure him somehow, to throw a wink at him, but I didn't want anyone to see that gesture, not with what was coming up. So, instead, I gave him a small shrug, turned back to Mab, and bowed my head. Then I hurried over to her.
Sir Knight, Mab said, her voice lowered to an intimate volume. You have annoyed a valuable ally. Explain yourself.
You don't want me to, I replied in a similar tone. Look, I need to ask you for something I never really expected to want from you. Mab arched a brow.
And that is?
Your trust, I said, that I'm acting on your behalf. Mab's eyes widened slightly. I need your assistance, I said. Look at the door Lara just left through, and then at me like you want to murder me.
For that, I shall hardly need to invoke a dramatic muse, Mab murmured.
But she thrust her chin toward the door Lara had just departed through, and then turned her wide, dark eyes back to mine.
This is a public pantomime you play for high stakes.
Her eyes narrowed dangerously.
Do not bring me embarrassment with your failure.
No, my queen, I said, loud enough for the room to hear. I stepped back from her and bowed deeply at the waist, before putting on an expression that I assumed looked angry and chagrined, and hurrying after Lara.
What good is it going to do to get us into the gym? Lara asked. I've seen it. There's no way down to the holding cell from there.
Murphy smirked. Like I said, you visited the place a few times. I lived there, especially in the gym. One of Marcone's people in the red jackets looked like he might disagree with me going up the stairs to the gym, but I pacified him with upraised hands and said,
I need to sort this out or my boss is going to kill me. Just give me a minute.
It was one of the same guys from the night before. The guard looked from me over toward Marcone's camp. Marcone didn't look up from his conversation, but Hendricks, at his right hand, gave the guard a nod. The guard stepped back with a grimace and said,
Watch that Freydis man. She'll gut you as soon as look at you.
Spoken like a three, I said. He looked confused. I kept moving. I came up the stairs to the soft sounds of Freydis's sobs. Lara was standing by the nearest corner of the boxing ring with her arms around the Valkyrie's shoulders. I checked the stairs behind me to be sure that they were empty, closed the door, and said,
Clear.
Oh, it's blood. I should have been an actress, Freydis said in a pleased voice, standing clear of Lara.
Well, the Ein Hajarin weren't buying it, I said. Everyone knows you're up to something.
Lara smirked at me. Vampiric allure completely aside, the woman had a smirk that was to die for, and her little black dress was stylish and stunning. She flexed her hands like claws and said,
Getting my hooks into Mab's night, of course.
Obviously, I said. I started for the back of the room where the towels were stacked on a shelf, ready to be used. I shrugged out of my suit coat and vest as I went, and then out of the shoes, pants, and shirt, until I was left in just boxer briefs and undershirt and socks. It was necessary.
I still believe this is a serious breach of security planning, Lara complained as she lifted her dress over her head and tossed it on a bench. She added her shoes more carefully and was wearing nothing else.
Excellently. I averted my eyes.
You don't know Ein Hajarin, Freydis insisted in a firm tone. Once they get it in their heads that something needs to be one way, that's it. That's how it needs to be. Lara sounded as if she was speaking with her nose wrinkled up.
Still, an old privy shaft?
Once they realized they could use it to drop their towels right next to the laundry room in the basement, instead of carrying them down in hampers, there was no stopping it, Freydis said. They just knocked holes in the wall with the dumbbells and started dropping towels down the shaft. Marcone had to give in with grace and installed dumbwaiter doors. I went to said door,
flipped a latch, and opened it.
It rolled up smoothly to reveal a shaft that began overhead and led straight down into the darkness. It was not excessively large. There was an incredibly wonderful smell, flowers and cinnamon, and something darker and sweeter. And then Lara was standing next to me, her bare shoulder against my elbow. My elbow approved ecstatically, but Lara jumped and let out a little truncated sound of discomfort. She glanced down at her shoulder, where a patch the shape, I guess, of the end of my elbow was turning red, as though she'd brushed it against a hot pan. Vampires of the White Court had a severe allergy to sincere love, the way the Black Court doesn't like sunbathing. Skin-to-skin contact with people who love and who are loved in return is hardest of all on the White Court. Which meant that...
Oh. Well, I hadn't been thinking about having that aura of protection around me when Karen and I got busy, but it was nice to have it. And it was nice to know it was real. Very nice.
Ouch,
Lara said, her tone annoyed. Then she glanced up at me and her expression became suddenly pleased.
Oh, you and the policewoman. Congratulations, wizard.
My relationships are none of your beeswax, I responded in a grumpy tone. Lara nodded at the old privy shaft.
We're both about to crawl down that together, so I'd say I have a minor need to know if I'm going to receive second and third degree burns for bumping into you.
She regarded the space gravely.
Small. Are you going to fit?
Stop setting me up for dirty jokes, I complained. I'll manage. Are you sure you can handle the guard?
Lara turned her head slightly toward me, her eyes down, and caught her lip between her teeth before slowly looking up at me. Suddenly the light fled from the room, except where it touched the pale perfection of her skin. I just about started howling and pounding my chest. I suddenly wanted her so badly. It took me a good long breath to get control of myself and force myself to avert my eyes.
"I'll manage," Lara murmured.